Chapter 36, The Last End. Section A, Existence of a Last End. Every man acts for an end. See Chapter 18, Section F. If we see someone acting at random, we gather that he is not acting rationally, i.e., like a human being. That is why, in order to educate a man, one has to appeal to his intelligence by showing him what things are for. To treat people as intelligent beings is to make them notice the end or purpose of things. But does this apply to man alone? Can we not say that everything acts for an end, not just every man? Quite. Everything has an end. There is no action, whether performed by a machine or by an animal or by anything, without an end. See Chapter 18, Section G. Nevertheless, what is peculiar to the spiritual creature, not only man, but angels as well, is not just to act for an end, but to direct himself to the end, because, 1, he knows it as end, and, 2, has the ability to guide himself. Human acts, as we said, are those which flow from the free will of man, but every act coming from an act of potency is caused by it with a view to an end or object. Thus, all human acts are for the sake of their end. St. Thomas also says that it is necessary for man to have an end, because, in the subordination of ends to higher ends, it is impossible to go on ad infinitum, since, if there is no first end in the intention and last in the execution, nothing will be desired and nothing will move. The philosophy of praxis, typical of Marxism, denies that there is any last end. For them, man is moved by practical needs. This is tantamount to denying also the real motivation for human activity. There must be a last end, since otherwise there is no end at all, and so no motivation. Moreover, the last end can only be one. It excludes any other last end, by definition, by necessity. It would be like saying that this car is going to this city and that city at the same time. If there are several ends or motivations, what happens is that they subordinate themselves to one, which then is the last. All that man wants, he wants it, at least implicitly, for the sake of a last end. Men do not differ, then, in envisioning a last end for everything they do, but they may differ in the way they identify that last end. Section B, Identification of the Last End. As we have seen in Chapter 23, Section D and E, God is the natural last end of man, because he is the fullness of the act of being, the essential goodness. Only God is first cause, i.e., the cause that produces the being of things, and it is not fitting for the first cause to act in order to acquire something. Therefore, when God acts, it is not in order to acquire something, but only in order to communicate his perfection. It is only proper to him to be the last end. Only God is the supreme goodness, because he is the supreme esse. Since goodness acts as a final cause, God is the last end of every participated good. This is how participated beings seek the fullness of being. Only God is an end to himself, because he is his own goodness. But all other beings have their end outside themselves, because they are participated, and so need to be completed. No created being can be the last end for itself, nor for any other being. Human love, for example, terminating as it does in a human person, cannot be the last end of man. Let us recall also that the object of the human will is the good as understood by the intellect. But how does the intellect understand the good? The intelligence forms concepts which are universal. So when it looks at goodness, it presents universal goodness to the will. Consequently, the will desires the fullness of goodness, of real goodness. But this total goodness cannot be found in anything created, but only in God. Therefore, The last end of man cannot consist in anything created, not even in the entire creation, because neither a portion of creation, nor the whole of it, is the totality of goodness. This explains the perpetual dissatisfaction of man in this life until he finds God. As we mentioned, every man desires happiness necessarily. Happiness, however, is not as such the last end, see chapter 35, section D, but only the consequence of loving God, who is the real last end. If one loves God because he can make him happy, the last end is no longer God, but oneself, and happiness is not thereby found. This is why the first commandment of the natural law, as well as the divine positive law, Bible, is to love God above all things and more than oneself. Only if this order to the end is kept, is self-love right. The way to love ourselves is by directing ourselves to our real last end, which is God. Not to do so is to destroy ourselves. Each creature tends to God as last end, but according to its own manner of being. Man does it by intellectual knowledge and willful love. The non-spiritual creatures reach their last end to the extent that they are similar to God by participating in being. By reflecting God's perfection in themselves, they give glory to Him, they imitate Him. But the spiritual creatures reach God by their own operations, because the intellect and will can have God as object, intelligence as truth, and will as good. Because of their freedom, they determine themselves to the end, while the other creatures are brought to the end. Section C. Natural Last End and Supernatural Last End. This natural ordination has been raised to the order of supernatural grace, whereby man is ordained to God supernaturally. By his natural ordination to God, man should love God as his last end to the extent that he is capable of knowing and loving Him through his natural powers. This natural last end is like a standard to measure the goodness of human acts by, showing their proportion or disproportion to that end. It is not correct to consider the direct ordination of man to God as peculiar to the supernatural order only. See chapter 17, section C. Human life and all its dimensions, temporal, individual, and social, is intrinsically ordained to God. What happens is that man has been taken up and raised by the supernatural ordination. The union with God required by the natural last end can only reach as far as the natural power of the creature permits. But it does not reach up to the participation in the intimate life of God, beatific vision, because this transcends all the capacity of the creature and constitutes precisely the supernatural last end. By this elevation to the supernatural order, what is only natural does not disappear. On the contrary, it is taken up, healed, enhanced, and raised. What the supernatural end does is to gather in itself the fullness of the natural end, taking it to an infinitely higher order, i.e., to the participation in the very life of the Blessed Trinity. By virtue of the natural ordination of man to God, there is in every man a natural desire to see God. This is not, however, a desire for the beatific vision, because if that were so, the supernatural order would not be, as it is, gratuitous, i.e., freely given by God. It would be due to human nature. So the desire for the beatific vision arises only after receiving the faith. The natural desire to see Him aims at seeing Him as He can be seen by a creature without any supernatural ordination as such, and would be satisfied simply with a natural knowledge of God. Not even in the beatific vision is there a desire to comprehend God, because this is impossible for the creature. See chapter 23, section F, in fine. The beatific vision is the intimate participation of the creature in the life of the Blessed Trinity, but not in the complete comprehension of God. The natural order, then, does not have the power to lead to the supernatural order, but it has an obediential potency, i.e., a capacity to be elevated by grace specifically in the spiritual creature. Animals do not have this obediential potency. See chapter 25, section E. Section D, possession of the last end, happiness. Happiness, as St. Thomas says, is called the supreme good of man because it is the attainment or enjoyment of the supreme good, which is God. This attainment of man's last end occurs through an operation which must be distinctly human, i.e., spiritual, through knowledge and love. While the happiness of God is his own being, the happiness of man is attained through the operation of knowing and loving God, which unites him to God and thus gives glory to his Creator. For it to be a perfect blessedness which satisfies all man's yearnings, it must be 1. Interminable, and 2. Stable. Happiness, therefore, is the stable and interminable possession of the supreme good which satisfies man's desire totally. Can this happiness be attained in this life? It can be attained, but only imperfectly. We can know and love God in this life, and insofar as this knowledge and love penetrates our human acts and our life, we are all the more happy. What is the content of this supernatural bliss? We speak of it as beatific vision. This vision corresponds, therefore, primarily to the intelligence, but the appetition and enjoyment which follow every act of knowledge, see chapter 29, section A, correspond to the will. So, it is neither the intelligence alone nor the will alone that enjoy the beatific vision, but the whole person knowing and loving God, and thereby being happy to the utmost. This eternal and boundless happiness is the accompaniment of the beatific vision. As we have said, man's natural powers are not sufficient in order to attain the beatific vision, but as an intellectual creature, man has the obediential potency of being raised to the supernatural order by grace. See chapter 21, section A.